Hello, everyone. Welcome to Queens of the Bees, your favorite queer movie and TV podcast, and ours too. I'm your host for today. I am the everyone's favorite Disney gay, TJ. I'm doing a little bit of a switch from the normal Pisces. I'm going to focus on my Disney gay identity, which is really important for this week's pod. And I'm joined, by, as always, by my co-hosts.
Aaron, who is the non-Disney
gay. He is the anti-Disney gay.
No, not anti, just non-Disney.
I don't know how I've managed to make it almost 7 years with a non-Disney gay, but be that as it may.
Well, somebody's got to take out the trash and change the tires.
I take out the trash, and you don't change tires.
When I take out the... You move the trash can, I take out trash all the time.
Well, I'm about to take out some... Anyway. What are we talking about this week?
Taking out the trash. No, wait. No. We're talking about the Little Mermaid.
We are.
Not the new Little Mermaid. Not the really, really, really old Little Mermaid. Just the kind of old Little Mermaid.
Yes. The original Little Mermaid movie.
Mm-hmm.
Released in 1989, of course. The inauguration of the Disney Renaissance. The apogee of Disney animation for the 90s. And a very near and dear film to my heart, as we'll get to when we get to the deep cuts section. I won't spoil the ending. But if you haven't, I can't imagine people don't know what The Little Mermaid is about by this point. I mean, it's been, you know, 30 years. I can't imagine that anybody doesn't know what it's about.
I mean, we just watched it last night and I still don't know what it's about.
Well, anyway, I guess we'll just cut this short. Seems like someone's not going to take this give this the seriousness that it deserves.
No, I'm sorry. I'm still just acting out because of having watched a Disney movie. It goes against everything I believe in.
Anyway, so the long and short of it is, it's about Ariel, the titular Little Mermaid, who wants to become part of the human world. She falls in love with a prince named Eric. The sinister sea witch Ursula gives her the ability to become a human for 3 days, but she takes her voice and says, you have to make this prince fall in love with you, or else I'm going to turn you into a polyp. And so that sets in train the whole thing. Ariel and Eric fall in love. Ursula tries to interrupt everything. Then Ursula almost becomes the most powerful person in the ocean until Eric rams a ship into her and she dies. And then Eric and Ariel end up together.
And this is a movie for children.
It is a very dark movie at points. So I think what we'll do for today is we'll foreground why we chose this movie, other than that it's relevant and topical because the new one came out. But I think that this film is a very queer film for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which is that Howard Ashman, one of the people responsible for the music, was himself a gay man. And, you know...
Well, if we're gonna do that, then, like, everything is queer, because we're behind the scenes on everything. So.
Well, it is true that musicals in particular tend to be very predominantly queer, in part because they are have been historically been helmed by, or inspired by, or costumed by queer people. Yeah,
exactly, you know, supported by us. You know, again, those particular jobs you mentioned are really historically important within the entertainment industry because they have for so long been safe places,
right,
for our kind of folks. There's even that book, Our Kind of People, that right, talks about the behind the scenes.
And obviously,
stuff.
It's no secret that there's a lot of queerness to Disney, and that queers in particular have always been drawn to Disney. Many books have been written about the subject, many essays have been written about the subject, blog posts have been written about the subject, but we're just joining our voice to this because I think it's important, and it's always a pleasure to sort of talk about and get into the nitty-gritty of what makes this film appealing to queer people, because I think people tend to just sort of use that as a shorthand without really talking about specifically what makes it queer. So that's what we're here to do today. And also because, you know, I think that one of the things that's most frustrating about the new remakes is that they lack the queer appeal of the originals, both in terms of the villains, and I've written about this myself, about the de-queering of the Disney villain and how that robs the film of a certain, like, electric charge, a frisson, if you will, that these originals had. But I also think that part of what makes these particular movies, starting with The Little Mermaid, so appealing to queer people is that they have all the elements of what Richard Dyer has referred to as utopia. And, like, you know, with energy, abundance, transparency, community, intensity, like, all the things we associate with the Hollywood musical are very much on display in The Little Mermaid.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think, for queer people who tend to be sometimes, at least his, like, in the 80s and early 90s, imprisoned in rather drab lives of heterosexuality and surrounded by heterosexuality, movies like The Little Mermaid provide an escape.
Mm-hmm. And also, frankly, it's just a musical, so that right there...
It is a musical. And I mean, that's one of the things that I always find really resonant with me is that this film feel like I don't feel it. It is a children's movie, I guess, in a sense, but it's something that I think is equally appealing to adults.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of winks and nods to queer people, and I think that helps to explain why it remains so enduringly popular for millennial and younger Gen X queers in particular. Mm-hmm.
But I think it's interesting that you mentioned the sort of the appeal for adults as well, because I think that's part of, okay, fine, I'll say it, it's part of the Disney magic.
It is.
I'll acknowledge the existence of such a thing, that they've understood for a long time, you know, since the push to make animation really for kids, because obviously animation didn't start out as being just for kids.
Right.
But in America, it kind of became a kid thing. But Disney, especially in its renaissance, very wisely understood as a business decision that in order to get kids to come, of course, you need their parents as well.
Right.
And of course, the way that kids are, the way they tend to want to watch the same thing over and 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 over again. In order to do that and not drive the parents completely insane, there has to be content in there that's appealing to them as well.
Yes.
And so that forces Disney to make these really well-crafted movies that really do work on multiple levels, for really for all of them, to give Disney credit for that, because they really mastered that approach.
Right, and it's really instructive then that in this film, they in particular, they return to the model of, like, not just the earlier model of musicals, which were, you know, the golden age of, you know, Cinderella and Snow White and Sleeping Beauty. But also, I would argue that a much more straightforward musical in this traditional sense, mm-hmm. like of a MGM integrated musical sense, mm-hmm. where the musical songs drive the plot.
Yes.
Like, they move the plot forward. They're not just sort of distractions. They are certainly spectacle, but they have a narrative function, mm-hmm, as exactly. well. But I think that that's part of the reason that queer people who, as we've said, historically have been drawn to the musical as a genre, would find, you know, both queer kids and queer adults would find something appealing and resonant with The Little Mermaid in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I know that I, as a queer child, like, found, I wouldn't have put it to myself in that way, but there is something, the plaintiveness with which Ariel expresses her desire for a whole, like, to join, you know, the part of the world that is outside of the humdrum existence that she leads under the sea, even before she meets Eric. It's mm-hmm. it's sort of, it's a, what is it? It's like a directionless longing. Like,
yeah.
There's no, like, object per se.
Yes.
It's just a feeling that you know that something is different, that you're different than mm-hmm. other people.
Yeah, and that difference requires you to leave. That the difference isn't something that can be sort of accommodated in the society where you're already grounded. You have to go away. You know, much like how New York and San Francisco historically were those places where queer folks kind of had to get away to from their hometowns in order to kind of live the lives that they wanted to.
Right, and that's why I think that actually Ashman's sort of presence as an author is important, because I think that that kind of is an experience that only a queer person would really grasp in all mm-hmm. of its complexity. Mm-hmm. I think it sneaks its way in. Mm-hmm. Even in those moments when, in Part of Your World, where Ariel's just, like, she's literally struggling for language to mm-hmm. articulate this desire, because I guess they don't have streets. And I mean, when she's, you know, groping for, what's that word, fire, mm-hmm. burn, and, you know, all those things of trying to formulate an identity that she knows she wants but can't yet fit into. Like, mm-hmm. that's such a brilliant articulation
yeah. Yeah.
of queerness right there.
And there, what you just said, I think, nailed it for me, because I was almost ready to just slightly push back a bit about when you said that only queer people would sort of appreciate that sort of having to go away. There are all kinds of other outcasts
sure.
for other reasons who could also very much relate to that idea of, in order to be me, I have to leave,
right.
as opposed to, I can kind of be who I am where I am. But I think you're absolutely right when you talk about that idea of sort of longing for an identity that you don't quite know what it is. That historically made a lot of sense for me, thinking about that in terms of queerness, because that would have made sense, especially in the past, for a lot of folks, where you know that there's something different about you, but that doesn't necessarily tell you who you are. It just tells you you're not like
right.
the other people around you. You have to kind of go and discover what it means to be the different that you are.
Right, and that's just one brief aside, and I started ranting about this last night. You told me to button it until the pod. So in some of the publicity for the new one of the things they said is that they've changed parts of A Whole New World to be more about Ariel's general longing as opposed to being Eric directed, but it's like, that's the whole point of the song. And the, like, she sings the song before she even knows Eric.
Mm-hmm.
There's the reprise when she after she rescues him and like he's on the seashore. But the song itself has nothing to do with Eric at first. Mm-hmm. It's just about a generalized longing for life on land.
And so here we are debunking some of the common criticisms made of this movie by watching the first couple of minutes of the movie. That's kind of all it took to debunk all of that criticism. Yep. I kind of wish people would maybe rewatch before offering those criticisms, because maybe they just didn't remember that.
This is important. I mean, this is just a general practice, I think, that what people would be best served to do is that I think people tend to make arguments about movies based on impressions. And I mean, that's understandable. Movies are a visual medium and often we misremember details, but that's why it's so important to rewatch something before you talk about it or write about it, because it gets the details right, because your whole interpretation should be based on details, not on your impression.
Exactly. If we can debunk your criticism that easily, that meant you didn't do your research.
Exactly. Which is kind of distressing that the people who are making the remake are making these criticisms.
Yeah.
But anyway, I digress. So, you know, I think that that moment when Ariel is singing of her desire before she sees Eric and falls in love with him is, you know, really symptomatic of the queer sensibility I think the film draws upon. And even if it doesn't draw it on it consciously, that helps to explain, I think, why a whole generation of queer people felt so much appreciation for this movie and why they still hold so much fondness for it. Yeah. And I think that, you know, obviously it's very much a Richard Dyer-esque, you know, longing for something that isn't in one's life as it is.
Yeah, exactly. And there's one other thing that I'll just sort of say generally about the story and or the premise of the story and why it might appeal to queer folks. And then I'm going to say it once and then I never want to say it again because it's an argument that I'm not sure how much I agree with it, but it's one that I've heard a lot and I don't disagree.
Mm.
And that's the idea that just the mermaid figure itself is one that sort of resonates as queer for a lot of folks, because it's this sort of half-like people that are sort of the people that surround you in society, but also this other thing that's different and not real.
Mm.
And for some folks, I can't say that I personally felt this way myself growing up as a queer kid, but other folks who have talked about how they kind of just felt like this weird creature that wasn't quite real. Until they finally kind of figured out who they were.
And as, I mean, a lot of people have also pointed out, certainly in the last couple of years, as more people have turned their attention to Hans Christian Andersen, or Hans Christian Lockerhuber, Golden Girls reference, to Hans Christian Andersen's original story and his own biography and his own particular bisexuality and his own longing and all that stuff, which may have found itself obliquely expressed in the film. So there's all sorts of layers to The Little Mermaid.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what makes it such a great movie, is that it has all of these layers that lend themselves to all kinds of appropriation.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that also the moment when Triton is condemning Ariel's desire for Eric, like after he's discovered, thanks to Sebastian blurting it out, that she's in love with a human, like that whole scene is also queer code. Like, it's not queer coded. I can see why queers would find that resonant because of the terms with which he condemns it. Like, your love is forbidden. Like, you, it's not just, obviously heteros would find it appealing too, but there's something distinctly anathema about it. Like, the repulsion and the revulsion with which Triton greets it makes it feel, I think, especially resonant for queer people if they were to be discovered, you know, with their forbidden longing. And then, you know, when he says, you're a human, she's a human, you're a mermaid, it's like, you're both boys, like, you can't, you know. That's what I was thinking. Like, it would fit so easily within that model.
Now, to be fair, and maybe I'm thinking about this way because of how you and I are also sort of different from one another, this could also easily have been a commentary on race.
Oh, that's
just
true.
As easily as it could be about that. So that's why I'm gently pushing back on the idea that this sort of is like special for queer folks.
True.
But I certainly take your point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that it's exclusively queer.
Yeah.
It is polysemous.
Yes.
As I think Barthes would say.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we don't need to get too highfalutin with our theoretical
apparatus. Why not? I think our audience can handle
That's true. I mean, that is kind of what we aim to do here. We've name dropped Dyer, we've named Barthes. Is it Barthes that meant, or is it Bakhtin? I don't know, it doesn't matter. But anyway, so lots of queerness there, but of course, I would be remiss if I did not talk about Ursula. Yeah, arguably, in my opinion, the queerest of all Disney villains.
Well, yeah, of course.
I mean, yes, there's Jafar, yes, there's Scar, you know, Maleficent, all of these people are obviously also queer, but when it comes to just straight up unrepentant, unruly, this utter bitchy queer, she takes the cake.
Yeah, I mean, She's a drag queen.
And she is, as has been amply documented, she is visually designed on Divine. And apparently from Pat Carroll's telling, who was the voice of Ursula, Ashman sort of acted out the performance to give her a sense of who this character was. And I mean, obviously visually, it's very easy to see how Ursula has all the performance accoutrement of a drag queen.
Mm-hmm.
The way she languidly like drapes herself over her, you know, alcove and says, "Wasted away to practically nothing. Banish the next." Anyway, so you know, all of that is the hyperbolic nature of queerness. There's also when she's singing "Poor Unfortunate Souls," the way in which, as an outsider herself and as a gender outcast, she mm-hmm. understands the performative nature of gender. Mm-hmm. You know, the infamous body language like mm-hmm. line, and her snarky but yet very apt description of how human men don't want women who talk. Mm-hmm. Like, it's all very a fascinating play with gender.
Yeah, exactly. And even just like her vocal performance, like, of course Pat Carroll was an alto herself, but the song is written, assuming that the score that I looked at is actually accurate, but I believe it was, it's very much right in a tenor range. Mm. And so it really is sort of crossing that what was thought of as traditional distinction between men's and women's voices for so long, where it's like women had to be either soprano or alto, and if you're a man, you're tenor or bass, by jumping down and singing this very much in a tenor range, because the song really overlaps my range almost perfectly. You know, that choice, because again, that's not where Pat Carroll's voice always sat.
Right.
Again, her voice, her natural singing voice was actually a little bit higher than that. So it was a choice to do that.
You know, I did not know that. This is why, ladies and gentlemen and NBs, like, I value Aaron's perspective, because he knows this music stuff much better than me. So, but I'm glad you brought that up, because I actually have written about and thought a lot about Pat Carroll's queer voice. Like, mm-hmm. her speaking voice is very rich, very deep, very throaty, of a Lauren Bacall kind mm-hmm. of way. And that's part of, I think, what, and this was true of her other roles as well. Like, if you look at Grandma and Garfield, for example, her other sort of big animated role, there's always something like rich and husky about it that I think, at least for me as a queer boy, like, always resonates with me. Mm-hmm. And like, it just appeals to me. Like, it's just fun to listen to,
you know. For me, I have to be honest, a lot of this, of what TJ said, he's relating it to his experiences of having watched this as a kid. I actually didn't see this movie for the first time until about 10 years ago, so I don't have any childhood associations with it. But that said,
you can imagine the look on my face.
But that said, that the vocal delivery reminds me of someone like a Bea Arthur or someone like that, who also was well known for being seen as someone who kind of like blurred those lines a bit.
Right. There was a rumor, and I have to actually confirm this was true, that Bea Arthur was in consideration to be.
It would make sense.
She was under contract with Buena Vista, who was Disney. But anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's part of what makes Ursula fascinating. It's not just the aspect of, like, the drag performance, but it's the vocal delivery and the richness of Carol's own voice. And as you rightly point out, that sort of is transgressive in mm-hmm. and of itself, just because of where it sits.
Exactly. And for me, the transgression for me lies in the fact that, again, it's very much a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Again, because people's voices are what they are. So it's since you mentioned BR, or I brought her up, I guess, first, who actually was a tenor for real, and then a baritone as she got even older. It's less of a choice for her to sing something like in that register.
Right.
So I wouldn't necessarily call that transgressive. But because it was such a choice mm-hmm. for Pat Carroll, I'm like, yes, transgression.
Yeah. And I mean, I've always enjoyed the way in which Ursula just sort of savors her entire existence, and like the duplicity and the openness with which she embraces her duplicity. Like, there's no question, as you pointed out, like, she knows who she is and she's not going to apologize for
mm-hmm.
it. And, you know, and not to get too psychoanalytic, but she's clearly like the monstrous feminine that is challenging the patriarchal phallic authority of Triton. I mean, it's kind of explicit. Was it, Triton's like trident. Like, you know, when she grows to this monster at the end of the film, which, you know, in a less capable film than Little Mermaid would seem silly,
mm-hmm.
but it somehow seems so appropriate. Like, because she gets so enraged, which, to be fair, she gets really mad because she accidentally kills Flotsam and Jetsam, her eels. Like,
mm-hmm.
when Ariel pulls her hair and she ends up frying them with the trident. If I accidentally fried my pets, I probably would be pretty angry too. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it makes sense that she would grow this, to this giant of horrible proportions.
But hey, she did it. She should be mad at herself. She did it.
Well, that's true. I mean, she was trying to take over the ocean for her own, you know, purpose. And one of the things that I find very fascinating about Disney villains writ large, and I think part of the reason that they are so compelling for queer people, is that it's not just that they are sort of weapons against heteropatriarchy, which they are, but it's also that, like, they don't always have a lot of motivation. Like, there's no narrative motivation other than they want to take over the world.
Yes.
Like, there's no, I mean, there's a hint that Ursula was banished, but we don't know why.
Aye, exactly.
Like, we don't know what was the horrendous crime she committed that earned her that, like, that banishment.
And that's one of the things that I actually kind of like about the movie, is that it's so intensely there that, and it's not even just sort of like the wanting to take over, it's the banishment and the obvious anger at Triton.
Right.
That's never quite explained. Like, there's history there that we just don't get to know.
Right. In one of the early drafts of the film, they were supposed to be siblings. Okay. Like, that was the original narrative explanation, but I think that fell by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would be kind of hard to explain how a fish and an octopus are siblings, but...
It's a cartoon about talking mermaid or talking crabs and mermaids. And all.
Well, that's true. But even within fantasy, there are still laws that you have to obey. Like, there has to be a certain system.
You just have to explain what it is, though, and then it works.
Well, anyway, so we don't really need that explanation, even as we're sort of led to want it. So it's a really interesting dynamic that Disney keeps up that is really useful. And of course, one of the things that a movie like Disney, as a traditionally narratively paced musical, has to expel her from the narrative, because she has to, you have to have the happy ending. So, yes. Of course, there's a moment when Eric literally takes the phallic ship and thrusts it into the gaping body of the unruly woman, and then she sinks beneath the ocean. Very spot on, pretty bluntly delivered patriarchal message.
Mm-hmm.
But even that, but I mean, it's not that thing that people remember. Like, the what makes Ursula sort of the queer disruption is that she's the person that people love and remember about that movie more than anyone else.
And also the thing that's, if we're going to stick with this, sort of really forcing the idea of her as queer, that in order for the movie to resolve that she had to die as opposed to simply be defeated.
Right.
Because like you said, she had to be removed from the story through her death.
Right.
Like, that fits into that much longer standing tradition of killing off the queer characters.
Yeah, bury your gays. And I mean, now that I think about it, most of the Disney villains from the sort of Renaissance all had to die.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, most Disney villains die.
Yeah.
Even Jafar dies in Return of Jafar, so he doesn't last beyond one movie.
Mm-hmm.
Scar dies. Frollo dies. Yeah, anyway. But basically, long story short, is they almost all die. So, I could have an entire podcast committed just to Ursula, and I would love to continue talking about Ursula, but there are some other queer characters that I think we can dive into. I would argue that Sebastian is kind of queer. I mean, we don't see him with any other partners, but I mean, there's also just something.
But also, how could we tell if it's a crab and another crab? How can you tell a boy crab from a girl crab?
Sure. I mean, that yes. But I also just, I think that he fits very nicely into the gay best friend. Like, you can see him being like, work girl. Like, yes. I mean, he's very reluctant at first to give Ariel the sort of permission to engage her little romance with Eric, but he then becomes her wingman, essentially, or shell man, I guess.
Exactly.
I mean, I guess, technically speaking, Scuttle would be more of her rather ineffective wingman. But, I like that about him. I think that he's one of those other characters that young gay boys could see themselves fitting into.
Mm-hmm.
Even Grimsby, the sort of older, advisor to Eric, I think also lends himself to a sort of queer reading in the sense of, this sterile, sort of fussy older man who, who is the accessory to the heterosexual romance.
Exactly. And for me, even more so than Sebastian, I think Grimsby fits that. Because as we were getting ready for this, that sort of role that he plays as the servant to the prince, that sort of like lifelong commitment to this one particular man, to the exclusion of one's own life.
Right.
There's a kind of queerness about that role. So not even just Grimsby, the specific character, but just that position in these types of stories sort of occupies that. It's like, in a sense, it's a man devoting himself to another man.
Right.
For life.
Yes. I mean, I only realized this as I was talking to during the pregame. There's also something to him about Edward Everett Horton, who was a very famous character actor of the 30s and 40s who played fussy, queer-esque characters, fairy characters in a lot of musicals of that period. I don't know that it's deliberate, but it's evocative for me anyway.
Yeah, and I would say that because this is an animated movie, I would call it deliberate, because it's not like they just had to cast a person who happened to embody those things. They had to draw frame by frame by frame, every right. little action, every little gesture, every little thing. So for me, that suggests a deliberateness to it. And I think that by having it be sort of coded as queer and never even resembling explicit queerness ties into the historical thing that you were just talking about, because this would have been from a time where you absolutely could not have had a character be explicitly queer. So being that kind of fussy type character is how we told people this guy is queer.
Right.
It is those mannerisms. It is that approach. That's what queer was, because it couldn't be any more explicit than that in the past.
Yep. I mean, just a fun little fact. The guy who plays the voice of Grimsby is a Disney veteran, having played the voice of Roger in 101 Dalmatians.
Oh, nice.
So, just a little random aside. He actually died very shortly after this movie was made. But, you know, aside from the fact that, you know, we have the queer longing, we have the sort of narrative of frustrated desires and yearning to be outside of the world, we have the queer villain, we have queer sidekicks. Now we have to talk about Eric. Mm-hmm. And I mean,
I know, your first love.
He was my first animated love. Now, I will say that my one true animated love will always be Aladdin. And that's partially because Scott Wagner is just so cute in real life. But also, Aladdin is just in... anyway, I don't want to wax poetic about Aladdin, but I think that there is something really uncannily handsome about Prince Eric that I think that for young gay boys like me, like, he was sort of one of the platonic ideals of, you know, what we wanted to end up with. Like, or what that we could yearn and desire for as young people.
Yeah, and like I said, since I don't have the childhood associations with
you're like,
this...
it's all you.
No, because you're certainly not the only person I know who feels this way. I mean, I feel like anytime anyone mentions Prince Eric, this comes up.
Yes.
But as someone who didn't see the movie until I was in my 30s, my response to that is, I'm like, I see him more sort of as just sort of the model of sort of dashing appeal that I can see serving as kind of an object of desire
right.
for folks. I can get it, even though I didn't obviously have those experiences myself.
And I mean, I want to use this as a jumping off point to a larger discussion about like why I find the live action remix so frustrating. Because I think that Eric, and the way that he's animated, is clearly, like, he's mostly a cipher. Like, there's not a lot of depth to Eric as a character. Like, he's just there to look pretty for Ariel to desire. Like, in the moment she lays on
the way a man is supposed to be.
Exactly. Well, it's actually fascinating that you say that, because he is the to-be-looked-at figure in this movie. Yeah. I mean, certainly Ariel is a figure, but she's meant to be our object of identification.
I mean, yeah, she's the protagonist. So
right, so she's the one that people are led to identify with. And it's really kind of nice that at this point, Disney at least was willing to give its female characters agency. Like, obviously much has been written about the way this film literally robs Ariel of her voice, and like she relies on Eric to save her and all this other stuff, but it is worth pointing out that for much of the film she's the one driving the action and doing things and singing of desire. Like, those are important and not to be dismissed, and she doesn't really spend that much of the movie not speaking. Like, I mean, yes, admittedly, for like 20 or 30 minutes, she's not doing much talking, but she's still acting.
Yeah, and
like
she's
still performing.
Exactly, and I feel like that criticism of, oh no, she's not speaking, I'm like, that's not the only way to communicate an act.
Right.
It's like, you can do all kinds of things without actually using your voice. And I'm part of me is screaming about this now, because as someone who like studied as a director, I feel like so many people misunderstand all of the levels on which people perform and then how all of those different levels of performance matter in terms of talking about how someone may be taking action or agency.
Right.
And I think that sometimes by privileging the word so much, we actually ignore so much of the actual action in scenes in movies like this and in other movies.
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, there is during Kiss the Girl, like, some people have said, well, she's not really consenting to him kissing. Like, well, yeah, she really is. I mean, it's very clear. Like, that's the whole reason.
There are other ways to consent other than literally saying the word yes.
Right. So, I just wanted to point that out, because, and then also, you know, like I said, Eric is a beautiful human to look at. But I think that part of what makes movies like The Little Mermaid so not just queer, but I think so appealing and why they were so hugely popular. Like, it's impossible to state how hugely popular these movies were.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the reason is because, you know, you referred to the magic of it earlier. Because I think that there's something really magical about traditional 2D animation.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't look real. And it's not supposed to.
Yeah.
And I think that that's part of my frustration with, no matter how pretty or beautiful the people they cast in these roles are, they're never going to be the same kind of beautiful as Eric or Ariel or anyone else. Like, mm-hmm. they're just not going to be, because exactly. these are not supposed to look real.
Exactly, and I think that's part of the reason why there's almost universal sort of, like, desire for Prince Eric, because he's not real.
Right.
Like, I don't think there is a human person that could be so universally considered as attractive, because real people look like real people, which means you're going to be some people's cup of tea and not others. Since he's just a drawn figure, it's a lot easier for him to just sort of be ideal.
Right. And I mean, I think that, again, this is not exclusive to queer people, but I think part of the reason that queer people are, at least like me, are drawn to animation is because it is the film of fantasy
mm-hmm.
in which queer people have often had to rely and in which they feel very comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, you know, to go back to what I said earlier about the utopian desire, there is something intrinsically utopian about traditional animation that nothing can quite replicate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that making these live action remakes, and even I think the switch to CGI to some degree, because even CGI, its desire is to look more realistic.
Exactly.
And I don't understand, like, why we all want realism. Like, did we forget that the whole point of movies to some degree is escapism?
And I certainly don't know why we want realism in a cartoon.
Yeah.
That I just have never understood, but that's just me.
Yeah, so that's, I don't want to, like I said, I don't want to belabor this point, because I could go on ad nauseum about mm-hmm. this.
Oh, but there was one, I forgot, I did want to say this thing about the animation in The Little Mermaid, because, like I said, I saw it for the first time about 10 years ago. I didn't remember, because it's, you know, one of the, you know, the last of the fully hand-drawn animated movies, that brings with it a bunch of sort of weird irregularities, just because of the vagaries of hand-drawn animation.
Yes.
Fully hand-drawn and hand-inked and all of that stuff, too. That I noticed it in the scene of for the part of Your World when she burst out of the water.
Yes.
There's times when the drawing of her face looks so odd that it doesn't match any of the other drawings of her face at any other moment in the movie that I didn't remember before. And I was just kind of like, oh yeah, that's what reminded me that this was hand done all the way through,
right,
as opposed to computer done at some point.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of like the flaws. It's like seeing the spots in old celluloid. Like,
mm-hmm.
there's something reassuring about the notion of, like, that this is a physical object,
mm-hmm.
like, this was made in a physical environment. Like, I, especially in this day and age where, you know, where discourses about physical media and streaming are very much, like, in the discourse and in mm-hmm. the air, it seems like it's very useful to
yes.
remind us of what went into these projects and what makes them so appealing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and since we're talking about sort of the human element there, I'm just going to just throw out there one thing that I didn't really get at before. We were talking about Pat Carroll and her voice. I also just wanted to talk a little bit about the voices.
Yes, I was going to actually say we should certainly talk about the music.
Because this is from 1989, this is, of course, before auto-tune and all of those sorts of things. So we're also getting a much better job of hearing real human voices, which is one of the appeals for me. Now, of course, there was still, you know, the use of what we call the studio magic to sweeten notes, and we've been doing that with
right.
music forever, but that's not like auto-tune. That's where you just go in and maybe one moment here or there kind of sweeten a note that was a little bit off, rather than just sort of processing every note that comes out of the singer's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, for me, this real humanness that I'm hearing when I'm hearing the singing, which I think is great since I'm seeing these non-human characters. The voices are really, it's really important that the voices humanize them for someone like me who's not totally into these Disney movies.
It still hurts my heart every time you say that, just so you know.
Right. But thinking about that, which I haven't looked at the new live action one, but I'm wondering about the use of auto-tune.
Yeah.
For, I mean, that.
At the very least, they cast someone for Ariel who can sing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm grateful for that, because that has not been the case at all in these live action remakes, which
yeah.
is very frustrating. In part because, as you say, like, part of the pleasure of a musical is hearing people who can sing perform and sing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what's nice about The Little Mermaid in particular. Like, you look at Samuel Wright, who plays Sebastian, like, in the performance of Under the Sea. Like,
mm-hmm.
that is, I mean, if any number in this movie exemplifies the utopian, it's that one, because it has all of it. It has transparency and, you know, the authenticity. It has the community. It has the intensity, the vibrancy, like all those things that we associate with utopia. Mm-hmm. Plus, it has some really great lines. Like, yes. I mean, it's truly that for me is the distillation of everything I love about this movie. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate the extent to which the Little Mermaid really did bring musicals back into American culture, mm-hmm. and made them popular, and that it set the model that almost every movie of the Renaissance followed to some degree or another. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's the other thing, like, worth remembering, is that these days it's hard to think of a Disney film of this type without the music, but like relatively few of them are traditional musicals in this way. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what is really great about this particular movie, and also the Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and The Lion King all fit that mold, as does Pocahontas and Hunchback. But as you get, like, particularly in the new Disney movies, even not even the live action, but even some of the, like, newer feature films, aren't musicals in quite this way. Encanto is, and I think that's why Encanto is so popular, is because, again, you have people who can actually sing. Mm-hmm. And also with Frozen. Like, that's why they work, is because they're traditional musicals.
Yep.
And I mean, unsurprisingly, love the traditional musical. And so I think that we owe The Little Mermaid such a huge debt for the extent to which it proved that could work.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, it's hard to imagine a world without Disney now, but I mean, in some ways, this film saved the company.
Yes.
Like, you know, much as I love the Disney films of the 80s, The Great Mouse Detective, Fox and the Hound, The Black Cauldron, Oliver and Company, like, they weren't tremendously successful. Oh, yeah. Like, certainly not to the extent that this one was. This one sort of, like, really brought Disney back from the brink.
Mm-hmm.
It saved the animation, and I think that we're all the richer for it. But again, maybe that's just my enduring love of this film.
No. I think you're onto something. Back when I taught a course on animation and sort of the history of animation in America, that was the exact point made in the textbook that we used for that class. So I know you're really onto something when you point that out. And what else was I going to say? Oh, I think another thing in thinking about sort of just that sort of history and the importance of this movie and how it fit, I think it was also important that by being a musical and doing all the stuff that you already talked about, it also tapped into, and I'm sorry that I often talk about, like, market and industrial stuff.
No, I think that's fine.
That by doing that, that also made the soundtrack an important product for these movies as well, because for someone like me, again, who didn't watch the movies for a lot of these things when I was a kid, I heard the soundtracks for all of them.
Right.
So that's how I was familiar with them, and that's a lot, and that for me is how, or not for me, that's how a lot of younger people get exposed to more traditional, like, musicals anyway, is by hearing the music first before they ever have a chance to maybe see a production of a stage show or something like that.
Right. And I mean, so I think that, you know, what makes this movie special is not just the music, too, but also, like, the visuality. There's a vibrancy to its visual palette, mm-hmm. that I really, again, to reference what I was saying earlier, is what makes it magical. Because, mm-hmm. like, whether it's the you look at, like, Ariel's hair, for example, is, like, and I think a lot about color, because I've written about color in my scholarly work, and I think color is really fascinating in that regard, because it's so desiring, and it's so much of what we are drawn to as humans, like, as biological creatures, like, we love color.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when you look at the vibrancy of The Little Mermaid, whether it's the Under the Sea number, or it's, you know, even Ursula's sort of black and purple and color, you know,
color palette.
Palette, thank you. Yes. You know, that color is not just associated with certain states, but it suffuses the whole film.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just desire. It's just desire made manifest, I guess, is what I'm getting at. And I love that. You know, I'm somewhat, not that I don't love black and white films. They have their purpose, and I think they have their own visual language, but for me, it's always color. Like, mm-hmm. It's not technicolor, but it's so close to it. And it has a similar kind of valence, mm-hmm. to it, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, we've covered a lot of ground in this 40 minutes. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, there's just a lot to talk about with The Little Mermaid. And I think that I suspect strongly that in 10 years, this is this Little Mermaid that people will still be talking about.
Yes.
Like, with all due respect to the new one, and I think that it's making some important strides in representation, and the racists can go suck an egg as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. I do think that it's this one that is going to still be regarded as canonical.
Yes, and, definitely.
I mean, maybe if they had remade this one first, if this had been the inaugural entry in the novelty act, and that is the remakes, mm-hmm. that might have been better served. I'm just not sure that the new one is going to act as the sort of cultural touchstone that this one was.
I don't think it can. Mainly because, not just because I don't think that it's good enough. I think that the original was just so influential.
Right.
That I don't think the secondary one can come along and take its place. I just don't think that any remake of it could.
Right. And two things are worth pointing out. Two very humorous things that... were not PG, shall we say. And if you know anything about this movie, as with many movies of the Renaissance, it had its sort of scandals, one of which is in the movie itself, and I've noticed that they cut this part out from this release that's streaming on Disney. But if you watch the original, there's a moment when the priest's knee moves, and everybody insisted it was an erection.
Oh, like, okay, yes, I do remember all of that.
Everybody insisted, and I mean, I didn't buy it at the time, and it's been explained away as being like, you know, he's just moving his knee because he's short and squat. And then the other equally infamous moment is the original clamshell case for the VHS release. Apparently one of Triton's castle looked like a penis, mm-hmm. like one of the towers, which I have, my parents have, I should say, the clamshell case for this original when it first came out.
And so does it look like a penis?
It does. But but according to the people who designed it, that was an accident. They just, you know, were rushing to get it finished before.
They didn't have their minds in the gutter like the rest of you people out there.
Well, it's like the dust that flies out under Simba and the Lion King, supposedly spelled out S-E-X. Mm-hmm. You know, this was all the urban legends. And I'm sure that, you know, some of it may have been a joke, but it's just one of those music anecdotes that surrounds these movies when they came out. And like, mm-hmm. we're all, oh my God, Disney, you know, is having perversion.
Yep. Planning. Corrupting the children.
Right. And I just, you know, one last thing before we move on is I do just want to say an acknowledgement to Howard Ashman, who died of AIDS while he was, he had made the Beauty and the Beast and was working on Aladdin before he died. Like, mm-hmm. I think that he is just another example of the many people that we lost to that disease at this time, and so that's I think part of the milieu in which this film is emerging and helps to give it, I think, the emotional texture that it has.
Yes, definitely.
And the same thing for, you know, the Beauty and the Beast. A lot of people have speculated that part of the reason the Beast in his isolation in his castle and, you know, the affliction is itself not exactly an allegory, but is Ashman's way of sort of working through his own status during the disease. So I just wanted to say, as a queer person who appreciates what Ashman brought to the Disney and how his influence is still felt now, even 30 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems like a good place to end. So give us a few moments to powder our noses and refresh ourselves, and we'll be right back we're going to do a double header. We're going to do both deep cuts, and I'm going to give Aaron a Are You Even Gay?
Nice.
All right, so obviously I don't think Aaron has a deep cut because, you know...
You do yours and then I'll say something.
Okay, so I'm going to try to keep it together because as people who've listened to this pod for a while know, I tend to get a little emotional like I did with Calamity Jane. So, you know, it struck me as I was watching this, you know, even during the overture at the beginning, I started getting choked up, which, big surprise, TJ got choked up. But in this case, there's a really good reason because my grandma wasn't a huge Disney aficionado. Like, she was much more of, like, old Hollywood, so she did like an occasional Disney movie, and one she really loved was The Little Mermaid. So I can distinctly remember when I was 5 going to see this movie with my mom and my grandma. So, you know, obviously my grandma has passed away, but watching this movie is a way of sort of reconnecting with her, like, and that's, I think, that kind of intergenerational fandom has a real potency. Like, I don't think that, you know, scholars have written about it, but I don't want to overanalyze or intellectualize it. For me, it's a deeply emotional and affective. And so, obviously, I find Disney movies very affecting. Like, I get choked up even without the other layer to it. But I don't know. There's just something about the overture that really, like, just gets me, you know, I'm not saying that I listened to it and then cried later last night, but I may have listened to it again and cried last night. But that's not a bad thing for me. Like, it's just very therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, like I said, there's, it's a fondness. There's a, not to, again, to get all academic, but I think that for me, The Little Mermaid is like an emotional palimpsest. Like, there's so many different layers to it. And, you know, it's a way for me to sort of reconnect with my grandma, even though she's no longer with us.
Mm-hmm.
Because she really, really loved this movie. Like, this was one of the sort of five Disney movies that she liked. It was this, Bedknobs and Broomsticks, Mary Poppins, Sleeping Beauty, and that might be it, actually. Might have just been four. So, you know, it's just one of those things that I really enjoy watching it just because it reminds me of the special times that I got to spend with her.
It's nice that you got to still do that. It's like every time you watch it, you still get to have that time with her again.
Exactly. It's like when I talked about Calamity Jane. Like, there's certain movies that just are, you know, have that resonance for me.
Mm-hmm. I'm like, that's awesome. See, that's gonna make what I say sound horrific by comparison, because that was so sweet.
Well, I am a pretty sweet person. So, what do you got for us?
I'm gonna do sort of a shallow cut instead of a deep cut. No, I'm kidding.
I mean, I have one of those too. If you want,
no, just kidding. But I'll follow just up. Kidding. Just kidding. No, for mine, it's like I said before. I only saw this movie for the first time in my 30s. Of course, I was familiar with it as a kid. You couldn't be a kid in America and not know about The Little Mermaid at the time.
You were too old and too cool.
Of course, I was born too old and too cool for that. But one of the things that watching it made me realize, because I ended up sitting down and watching it with one of my friends, because I was just so tired of all of the horrified responses I got from all of my gay male friends when I said that I had never seen it before. And then watching it made me realize that, you know, I'd missed out on something, because it really is a good movie. And that, and I realized that for a long time, like so many of us, you know, we wonder how we will fit into various queer communities that we find ourselves in. You know, I was living in California at the time and made a bunch of gay friends out there while I was living there. But of course, you always wonder how you will fit into that. You know, for me, especially being black and surrounded by mostly not black people, you know, will I fit and all that? And fitting in fine in all of these ways, and finding that the way that I consistently felt like an outcast was the fact that I wasn't a Disney gay. Like, that was the thing that made me sort of stick out and feel like I was different.
And rightly so. I don't understand non-Disney gays.
but it's okay. I wouldn't say that I fully embraced the Disney thing, but I've become okay with it. Like, I've been to Disneyland a couple times now.
I mean, I haven't, so that's one thing you have up on me.
But I've become willing to sort of let that in, and all of it has been, for me, tied to my experience sort of as a gay man, because that's how I got to go to Disneyland, was like gay days and going up with my friends that I used to sing with, or, you know, going up for a gay day celebration, that kind of stuff. That watching The Little Mermaid is a part of all of that kind of experience for me. So it really is a part of my queer experience, but just as a grown-ass adult rather than as a kid.
Right. Well, that's fun. I mean, that's valuable. Like, because I think that, you know, Little Mermaid and Disney generally is, as you say, a bonding experience for many gay men. Mm-hmm. Like, the fact that we even have a designation as Disney gay is revealing. Which reminds me, the other shallow cut that I have is I started to watch this with a young man I was having a very brief fling with. But unfortunately, we got, I think, through, like, the first 5 minutes, and then we ended up having sex and never actually watching The Little Mermaid.
You whore.
I know. We don't use that kind of language here on this podcast.
You ho.
That's, I mean, we just used the C word, like, the last time we had an episode, so I don't
You
think...
used that word.
Well, anyway, so moving right along to the Are You Even Gay? And this is a surprise Are You Even Gay? Mm-hmm. So
lay it on me. I'm ready.
So, have you heard of the song Padum Padum?
No, I've not heard of any songs.
Well, that's obviously not true. But I have to say that I am deeply dismayed, disgusted,
frustrated. What is this song again?
It's called Padum Padum.
And this is the title of a song.
It is, but it's not the song that is important. It's who sings it that makes me horrified you haven't yet heard of it. It's a Kylie Minogue song. It's the new Kylie Minogue single. So to flash back to when my former co-host was on this show, he had never heard of Kylie Minogue or had not really listened to her, and I was horrified. I have to at least assume that you've listened to Kylie Minogue at some point in your gay history. I would have to, like...
I mean, her cover of Locomotion, that's pretty much what I know. Because I'm old.
No. There is no way you can use that. No, as a
and shield. I know, because she came back again while I was in college, and so she was
what
super
are you
popular
talking
again.
About? She was popular while we were both in. Ugh.
No, she became like super famous again. Like she was not huge the entire time she had a career. She kind of fell off for a while and then reemerged.
Anyway, so she does have a new signal out. Mm-hmm. It has become very popular among the Twitter gays, trademark. Mm-hmm. And I listen to it. It is a banger. It is a bop, as the kids say. I think that's
do they?
Anyway, it's a great song. It's meant obviously to be like, you know, a heartbeat, padum padum, like that's the
yes.
So
then why not call it Heartbeat?
Oh. Well, now I not only do I have to ask, are you even gay, because you haven't heard it, but this constant aspersion casting also requires me to interrogate you. Are you even gay?
I mean, honestly, I think that's fair on this one. That's a fair question.
I mean, at first, I thought I was wondering if I was even gay, because I kept hearing. I mean, now, of course, it's become memed, so that's always a significant moment in any pop culture object's life, is that it becomes a meme. So now, it's everyone refers to you padum, like, and if you don't know it, then you're just not in part of the joke.
Yeah.
And, well, you're not on Twitter anyway, so.
Yes, I am not one of the Twitter gays.
Which you should be very grateful that
yes.
you are not. It is.
I wouldn't mind becoming a Disney gay. I will never become a Twitter.
Oh
gay.
Yeah. So we're gonna be watching Disney movies next.
I didn't say that.
They're only an hour and a half long. Which reminds me, that's one thing I really love about The Little Mermaid, is that we get everything in an hour and a half.
I was like, that's my favorite part of the movie.
Yes. Take a lesson. That's one thing I cannot stand about this new one. It's over 2 hours long.
Yeah,
I don't understand why we need
that's never gonna happen. Sorry.
Ugh, anyway, I don't want to go off on that. But an hour and a half, feature length, perfect. You have your beginning, middle, and end. You have a romance. You have a villain. You have everything.
Mm-hmm.
You have a giant octopus almost taking over the ocean, all in an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Like that is storytelling right there.
You get in, you get out, move on
Boom.
With your life.
Anyway, take note, Hollywood. Bloat is not always good. So anyway, so you are gay, I assume, even though you have not heard of the padum padum.
That is true, although I can understand why someone would be tempted to take my card back from me for this.
I am incredulous and horrified and mortified and horrified. W-H-O-R.
And all of the fines.
I'm horrified. Anyway. All right, so give us one more second. We'll be right back to do our outro. All right, well, thank you, everyone, for joining us for what I hope you will see as one of the better episodes of Queen to the Bees.
They're all better episodes.
They are all better episodes, but this will be the jewel, one of the jewels in our crown, if you will.
Yes.
So, I'm not even going to bother, because we've already discussed that Aaron is not really on social media, much to his benefit. I think he is definitely wiser than I. I am a vainglorious narcissist, so I need the constant approbation that comes in sometimes with social media, even as I also get really frustrated and annoyed.
Whereas I am too old for this shit to be involved in social media, so I just don't do it.
Absolutely. So anyway, so you can follow me personally on Twitter at TJ Weston the number 3. You can also find me on Instagram at Thomas Weston the number 3. You can also follow our Queens of the Bees Instagram at Queens of the Bees, all one word, where we do post sort of snippet reviews of both the films we watch on here, but also of various other things that we're watching or that I'm watching, both film and TV. So please feel free to check us out there. You can also follow my Substack newsletter, Omnivorous, where I write about gay stuff. I will often elaborate on some of the things we talk about here on the pod. Sort of, you know, if you don't want to listen to our whole hour spiel, you can get the distilled version and some of the essays I write. Also, please subscribe, because I need it and we like money. So please also, speaking of which, remember to rate or review us wherever you get your podcasts, whether it's Apple or Spotify or wherever. Share with your friends. You know, send us $1 million.
Yes.
You know, that last part in particular.
Yes, that's what I want you to do. I will go on social media if you will give us $1 million.
There you go. That's your inducement. Yes. He will go on social media if you will send us $1 million. But anyway, seriously, we appreciate every one of you who tunes in to every new episode, and we, you know, love all of our listeners equally, but please do remember to rate or review us, because it really does help build our visibility. So, for Queens of the Bees, I'm TJ.
And I'm Aaron.
And we will see you next time.